on the Lyric Concert.
Brian Bowdell, your memories go right back to school days as regards composition, don't they?
They do. I had a most inspiring teacher of music at school.
Was this at Rugby?
That's right, yes.
Yes.
I mean, I hated the place except for the music.
Yes.
And he really set me off.
And would that be when your Opus 1 dates from?
Yes, my first works were songs which I wrote just before I left Rugby. One of those songs is still all right, I think.
Is it a setting of Joyce?
No, that was a setting, funnily enough, of a poem by the headmaster at the time.
Really?
Hugh Lyon, Wild Geese.
Mm-hmm. You went on to Cambridge then, but you didn't study music at Cambridge. You were actually studying chemistry, wasn't that right?
Yes. Well, it was a funny situation there because I got a choral exhibition to Clare College, which meant that I had the duty of training the college chapel choir. And I found that in my scientific career, which I was following in Cambridge there, that some of the lectures were so bad, and you didn't have to attend lectures, that I did nearly all my scientific work during the vacation, because I was very keen on that, actually, and had my own laboratory. But I spent all the time in Cambridge at music.
Yes.
And had wonderful experiences, notably as a member of the Cambridge University Magical Society under that great man Boris Ord, which implanted a love of Renaissance music for the rest of my life, and running the College Music Society and all the rest of it. Most active time.
Were you involved in any way in Anglo-Irish literature at the time? Were you interested in Anglo-Irish literature?
Oh, yes, well, of course, being at Rugby School made me into an ardent nationalist. Especially after my housemaster's report, which I think now would cause a lawsuit. My housemaster actually wrote in my report, must not make his nationality an excuse for his behaviour. So I became a very, very strong nationalist, which led me, of course, to Irish literature, and Yeats and Joyce were particularly interested. I was reading them avidly at Cambridge.
After Cambridge, you did start to study music then at the Royal College of Music, didn't you?
Yes, well, my father wanted me to be a scientist because the idea was I should go into the family business of making malt for Guinness, and I was to be the scientific expert. And he said, well, now, if you get a good degree, I will then let you have your wish and you can have a musical education. And fortunately, I got a good degree, and so he allowed me to go to the Royal College of Music in London. Unfortunately, my studies there were interrupted by the outbreak of war, but the year I had there was enormously valuable. Well, particularly living in London, where so much music was available.
What about the composition teaching there? Did you think it was good?
It was fascinating. I mean, I made lifelong friend of Paddy Hadley, who was my chief composition teacher. Again, funnily enough, one of those totally forgotten composers. He was one of the sort of hopefuls in England at the time. Nobody's heard of him at all as a composer, really.
Yes, and did you come across Herbert Howells in the Royal
College? Yes, well, I was just going to tell you about that. I mean, Paddy Hadley had a habit of going on the booze every now and then, and when he was incapable of taking his classes, he'd hand you over to Herbert Howells. And I think that resulted in the very best composition lesson I ever had. I've always felt that you can really only teach technique. That if you tell a student too strongly how he should do the thing, he just becomes a clone of the teacher. But I went one week having set a rather romantic poem as a song. And I remember Paddy looked at the thing and he said, that's a very crawly bass. Let's have some decent manly jumps. Go back and write it again. And let's have a nice bass. And so I rewrote the song and came back next week. Paddy was on the booze. So I was sent to Herbert Howells and he looked at my song. He says, that's a very angular bass. You know, it's a romantic song. Let's have some nice drooping semitones here. Nice chromatic writing is what we need here. Totally opposite views from two very respected people. And that's what really convinced me that you've just got to be your own very strong critic.
And you just mentioned technique there, though. Yeah. You're a very strong believer in composers having a good basic technique. And I think I read somewhere you carped slightly at some of the composers now who mightn't have that grounding.
Yes, I believe very strongly in mastery of the material, which then releases you to express oneself. And that happens in all the arts, I think, now, that there's too much the idea of sort of... it's the idea that matters, not how it's done. And also things are made a little bit too easy with electronic keyboards and all that sort of thing. I do believe that the effort in trying to make a work of art is very, very important. That effort. I mean, why did Bach bother with impossible things like invertible counterpoint at the 11th and all the rest of it? Most people would never notice that it is invertible counterpoint at whatever it is, but I'm quite sure that it is the actual effort of trying to work out a problem like that that releases the expressive instinct in the composer.
Can I go back now to your time in Dublin? You came back to Ireland. You were a pacifist.
Yes, that's
during
right.
The war.
Yes.
Came back to Ireland, and there was a little concert held in the Shelburne, which was that the first public performance of your work?
Oh, it was. Quite a remarkable thing. First of all, I mean, the number of people to whom I'm eternally grateful in that concern. What occurred to me, first of all, was I was painting myself at the time quite a lot, and mixing with a lot of the painters, and noticing they had one-man shows. Well, why shouldn't a composer have a one-man show? Mm. It just wasn't done, of course. And then my father, very kindly, even though he didn't really settle down to accepting that his son should become a musician, which just wasn't in his game at all, but he very kindly hired a room for me in the Shelburne Hotel. And then, you see, something else which has totally changed today. My colleagues, the leading musicians of the time, such as Betty Sullivan, the cellist, who's still alive, and several others, there was no question, they were so keen on helping each other and us and everything, that they played my works without any payment at all, just because this is the sort of thing we like doing. And so I had a complete string quartet there. I played my own oboe quintet. My wife was a singing pupil of mine. She sang some songs I'd specially written for her with string quartet. And a string trio was performed there. And
that's been recorded a number of times, I think.
It has, yes.
String trio. Yes. And at the same time, you were writing incidental music for the Olympia Theatre.
That was my first paid job, I think. There was a curious partnership. Michael Walsh, who was the pseudonym for Nigel Heseltine, who was son of the composer,
yes,
Peter Waller.
Yes, connection there, yes.
He was in Dublin. It's a long story, but I won't go into his character, most extraordinary one. He palled up with Sheila Richards, and they put on a series of plays at the Olympia Theatre. And I was asked to write the incidental music. I remember extraordinary business, appearing every night and conducting a funny little theatre orchestra in the Olympia. And then for the next play, I wrote for two pianos, and Billy Boucher and I appeared in evening dress in the orchestra pit every night playing two pianos.
Did you ever get paid for that?
No,
I remember reading some of your difficulties.
I had terrible trouble.
Yeah.
And then I started sending postcards until some legal person said, you know, it's illegal to demand money on a postcard.
Oh.
So then I sent letters without the stamp.
That's something I never knew. It was illegal to demand money on a postcard. We're going to hear now part of your violin concerto, which you wrote in 1954. And this is the slow movement. We'll talk about the possible Irish influences in the slow movement after we've heard it. But this is the slow movement of Brian Boydell's violin concerto. Thank you. The slow movement of Brian Boydell's violin concerto, the soloist was John Kitchen. That dates from 1954, and it was commissioned by Vanacek, wasn't it?
Well, not actually commissioned. He asked me to write a violin concerto. I remember I was very reluctant to do it because I don't like virtuosity in music. The idea that the soloist is more interested in himself than in the music he's playing. And I always feel, for instance, that when Joachim gave a lot of advice to Brahms for his violin concerto, that he covered the thing with so many frills that it becomes almost un-Brahmsian. Mm-hmm. And so I was a little bit reluctant because I know that if you're going to write a violin concerto, it's got to be reasonably showy or nobody's going to bother about it anyway.
So how did you reach that accommodation with yourself?
Yes, I did, really, as a challenge. Mm. I've always liked challenges and wrote the work. I actually revised that quite considerably because I learnt then a rather interesting thing that a lot of people don't learn, perhaps, in composition, and that is when you're writing the music down, you don't get the right sense of proportion between slow bits and fast bits. I mean, 4 pages of fast music, you see, flash by in no time. 1 page of slow music lasts for ages. And I got the proportions wrong in the last movement and rewrote it.
And yet you generally don't revise.
I generally don't, no.
Yes.
Because I find that once one's written a work, you move on to a different kind of mood for the next work, and the mood may have changed by the time you revise, which then will cause trouble.
The slow movement of the violin concerto, people say, does show a kind of Irish influence, but that's not something you generally see yourself as being particularly Irish in your compositions.
No, I've always rather disliked, if you like to call it sort of insular nationalism, sort of thinking that one's own folk song is the most wonderful thing in the world. I'm not denying that Irish folk music is absolutely wonderful, but I never wanted to follow in the hearty Stanford tradition.
Yes, you had some harsh things to say about that, I think.
Well, I thought, you see, it was complete distortion because genuine Irish folk music is not meant to be accompanied by Brahmsian harmonies. The two just don't marry. And I think this mismarriage, producing music which I term the plastic shamrock, because it sold awfully well in America, I turned very much against that. It perhaps went a little bit too far to the extent then that I never actually used folk songs in any of my music except when I was commissioned by the BBC to write a piece. That was the Sheila Martin Suite, which people have liked a bit.
And yet you would agree that there is a kind of unconscious, perhaps, Irishness about, say, the slow movement of that violin concerto.
Yes, let's look at it this way. I mean, how does folk song arise? Folk song arrives through the spirit of the people, and the spirit of a people is very much connected with landscape, with geology, and many, many other things, closeness to the land. Now, I don't see, to me, if you use folk song, the thing is secondhand. I'd rather express myself as somebody who is close to the land of the country.
You've written 3 string quartets and a movement for a string quartet. Which
three and a half.
Three and a half, yes. But I read somewhere that if everything else you composed was lost, you would like to keep your 3 string quartets. Why?
I think that's true. Well, I regard the string quartet really as the ideal medium. You see, you can't cheat. With an orchestra, you can make all sorts of funny noises. Which can dress up a paucity of musical ideas. In fact, there's an awful lot of funny noise music knocking around today, which hasn't much else except funny noises in it. You can't do that with a string quartet, at least only a very limited way with sort of using... Yes, I mean, I have heard a quartet in which people bang the back of the fiddles, so the fiddle player doesn't like it. But on the whole, the string quartet, it's got to be good music or else it won't work. And it's the purity of the expression and the enormous possibilities of the quartet as a medium, which always fascinated me.
I've heard that you use the octatonic scale in some of your music. Now, I didn't know until yesterday what an octatonic scale was, but would you agree that you do, and would you tell us what it is?
Yes, well, I don't like calling it that because it doesn't really mean an awful lot. It just means 8 notes, doesn't it? I think it's much easier to say that. Rather unconsciously, I don't know where it came from. but I found myself using a scale of alternate tones and semitones. Ta ta ti ta ti ta.
And have you any idea where that comes from?
Well, I believe Messiaen used it, but when I was using it, I hadn't heard it in the music of Messiaen.
Were you ever accused of copying him?
I was. I remember Archie Potter. Archie was one of those people, rather like Churchill talking about the Nazis, who refused to say a foreign word correctly. I remember he said, "That boy Del Work is just pure Messiaen." I remember.
And was it? You
no,
denied
No, I hadn't heard any Messiaen at the time.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, it's funny that.
Yeah, but I know that you're a very humorous man, having heard your lectures and been entertained by them. Is it important to have a sense of humour in music? Is it possible to have a sense of humour in serious so-called music?
Well, you've used the very term there that I might pick up to see. It's awfully hard to describe the kind of music I'm interested in. Classical music gives the wrong impression because to the musician that means 18th century music mainly. And then, you see, they keep talking about serious music. But music can be great fun. All right, serious humour if you like. But I've always believed in writing fun music as well, which, I mean, is just as well done, I hope, as serious music. And I believe very strongly in sense of humour in music. After all, Bartok, many other great composers have great sense of humour.
Check out our website at rte.ie/lyricfm/concerts.